So far, the thing had shown no signs that it was aware of their presence. It had merely flowed forward like the mindless tide that it almost certainly was. Apart from the fact that it climbed over small obstacles, it might have been an advancing flood of water. And then, when it was only 10 feet away, the velvet tide checked itself. On the right and the left, it still flowed forward, but dead ahead, it slowed to a halt. "We're being encircled," said Jerry anxiously. "Better fall back until we're sure it's harmless." To his relief, Hutchins stepped back at once. After a brief hesitation, the creature resumed its slow advance, and the dent in its front line straightened out. Then Hutchins stepped forward again, and the thing slowly withdrew. Half a dozen times the biologist advanced, only to retreat again, and each time the living tide ebbed and flowed in synchronism with his movements. "I never imagined," Jerry told himself, "that I'd live to see a man waltzing with a plant."
"Thermophobia," said Hutchins. "Purely automatic reaction. It doesn't like our heat."
"Our heat?" protested Jerry. "Why, we're living icicles by comparison."
"Of course, but our suits aren't, and that's all it knows about."
"Stupid of me," thought Jerry. "When you were snug and cool inside of your thermosuit, it was easy to forget that the refrigeration unit on your back was pumping a blast of heat out into the surrounding air. No wonder the Venusian plant had shied away."
"Let's see how it reacts to light," said Hutchins.
He switched on his chest lamp, and the green auroral glow was instantly banished by the flood of pure white radiance. Until man had come to this planet, no white light had ever shone upon the surface of Venus, even by day. As in the seas of Earth, there was only a green twilight, deepening slowly to utter darkness. The transformation was so stunning that neither man could check a cry of astonishment. Gone in a flash was the deep, somber black of the thick piled velvet carpet at their feet. Instead, as far as their lights carried, lay a blazing pattern of glorious, vivid reds laced with streaks of gold. No Persian prince could ever have commanded so opulent a tapestry from his weavers, yet this was the accidental product of biological forces. Indeed, until they had switched on their floods, these superb colors had not even existed, and they would vanish once more when the alien light of Earth ceased to conjure them into being.
"Tikhov was right," murmured Hutchins. "I wish he could have known."
"Right about what?" asked Jerry, though it seemed almost a sacrilege to speak in the presence of such loveliness.
"Back in Russia, 50 years ago, he found that plants living in very cold climates tended to be blue and violet, while those from hot ones were red or orange. He predicted that the Martian vegetation would be violet, and said that if there were plants on Venus, they'd be red. Well, he was right on both counts. But we can't stand here all day. We've got work to do."
"You're sure it's quite safe?" asked Jerry, some of his caution reasserting itself.
"Absolutely. It can't touch our suits even if it wants to. Anyway, it's moving past us."
That was true. They could see now that the entire creature, if it was a single plant and not a colony, covered a roughly circular area about 100 yards across. It was sweeping over the ground as the shadow of a cloud moves before the wind, and where it had rested, the rocks were pitted with innumerable tiny holes that might have been etched by acid.
"Yes," said Hutchins, when Jerry remarked about this, "that's how some lichens feed. They secrete acids that dissolve rock. But no questions, please. Not till we get back to the ship. I've several lifetimes' work here and a couple of hours to do it in."
This was botany on the run. The sensitive edge of the huge plant thing could move with surprising speed when it tried to evade them. It was as if they were dealing with an animated flapjack, an acre in extent. There was no reaction, apart from the automatic avoidance of their exhaust heat. When Hutchins snipped samples or took probes, the creature flowed steadily onward over hills and valleys, guided by some strange vegetable instinct. Perhaps it was following some vein of mineral. The geologist could decide that when they analyzed the rock samples that Hutchins had collected both before and after the passage of the living tapestry. There was scarcely time to think, or even to frame the countless questions that their discovery had raised. Presumably, these creatures must be fairly common for them to have found one so quickly. How did they reproduce? By shoots, spores, fission, or some other means? Where do they get their energy? What relatives, rivals, or parasites do they have? This could not be the only form of life on Venus. The very idea was absurd, for if you had one species, you must have thousands. Sheer hunger and fatigue forced them to a halt at last. The creature they were studying could eat its way around Venus, although Hutchins believed that it never went very far from the lake, as from time to time it approached the water and inserted a long, tube-like tendril into it. But the animals from Earth had to rest. It was a great relief to inflate the pressurized tent, climb in through the airlock, and strip off their thermosuits. For the first time, as they relaxed inside their tiny plastic hemisphere, the true wonder and importance of the discovery forced itself upon their minds. This world around them was no longer the same. Venus was no longer dead. It had joined Earth and Mars. For life called to life across the gulfs of space. Everything that grew or moved upon the face of any planet was a portent, a promise that man was not alone in this universe of blazing suns and swirling nebulae. If as yet he had found no companions with whom he could speak, that was only to be expected, for the light years and the ages still stretched before him, waiting to be explored. Meanwhile, he must guard and cherish the life he found, whether it be upon Earth or Mars or Venus. So Graham Hutchins, the happiest biologist in the solar system, told himself as he helped Garfield collect their refuse and seal it into a plastic disposal bag. When they deflated the tent and started on the homeward journey, there was no sign of the creature they had been examining. That was just as well. They might have been tempted to linger for more experiments, and already it was getting uncomfortably close to their deadline. No matter, in a few months they would be back with a team of assistants far more adequately equipped and with the eyes of the world upon them. Evolution had labored for a billion years to make this meeting possible. It could wait a little longer.
For a while, nothing moved in the greenly glimmering, fog-bound landscape. It was deserted by man and crimson carpet alike. Then, flowing over the wind-carved hills, the creature reappeared. Or perhaps it was another of the same strange species. No one would ever know. It flowed past the little cairn of stones where Hutchins and Garfield had buried their wastes, and then it stopped. It was not puzzled, for it had no mind. But the chemical urges that drove it relentlessly over the polar plateau were crying, "Here! Here!" Somewhere close at hand was the most precious of all the foods it needed, phosphorus, the element without which the spark of life could never ignite. It began to nuzzle the rocks, to ooze into the cracks and crannies, to scratch and scrabble with probing tendrils. Nothing that it did was beyond the capacity of any plant or tree on Earth, but it moved 1,000 times more quickly, requiring only minutes to reach its goal and pierce through the plastic film. And then it feasted on food more concentrated than any it had ever known. It absorbed the carbohydrates and the proteins and the phosphates, the nicotine from the cigarette ends, the cellulose from the paper cups and spoons. All these it broke down and assimilated into its strange body without difficulty and without harm. Likewise, it absorbed a whole microcosmos of living creatures, the bacteria and viruses which, upon an older planet, had evolved into 1,000 deadly strains. Though only a very few could survive in this heat and this atmosphere, they were sufficient. As the carpet crawled back to the lake, it carried contagion to all its world. Even as the morning star set course for her distant home, Venus was dying. The films and photographs and specimens that Hutchins was carrying in triumph were more precious even than he knew. They were the only record that would ever exist of life's third attempt to gain a foothold in the solar system. Beneath the clouds of Venus, the story of creation was ended.